Okay, well, thanks for coming. Yeah, this is the fourth, I believe, talk in yeah, there were two talks by Abai, a series of talk, pedagogical talk on loop quantum gravity. There were two talks by Abai in which he introduced, I understand in some detail, the kinematics, and then one by John Bites dealing with application of his theory to black holes thermodynamics. So when I arrived, which was after all this, Abai told me, okay, so you do the last part, the easy part, the dynamics. okay, so I'm going to start. I will not go through an introduction about motivation and things, given this is the, so to say, a sequel. I believe Abai has already introduced the ideas behind all that. But I will very briefly review the basics of the kinematics, just to remind you what things are, and fix notation and introduce a couple of ideas. And then discuss the two constraints, how they are implemented and constructed, implemented in the theory, which contain the dynamics of the theory. And the last part, I will discuss a way for actually studying the dynamics defined by the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the covariant version of the canonical theory, which is an area of development which has grown a lot in the last few years. So this, I guess, will give you an update of recent things happening in this field. In the first three parts here, I will not go into technicalities and detail. I will skip a lot of stuff, but I will be a little bit more precise. This will be more a overview of things going on than a detailed construction of things. So let me begin super rapidly, because I believe you have seen that many times. This is classical general relativity, the formulation, the canonical formulation we start from. There is a field, and these are the constraints. The field are defined on a compact three-dimensional manifold. The theory is background independent in two senses. First, because there's no metric here. So nothing in the construction will follow will depend on a metric on the manifold which the field leaves. Second, because of the diffeomorphism invariance, in some sense that it will illustrate, the manifold itself will be washed away by the kind of diffeomorphism invariant version of the theory. The localization of things of the background is irrelevant. So in that sense, so there are two background independences here, so to say. One is the absence of the metric, and one is the fact that everything will be defined up to arbitrary diffeomorphisms of the field on N. This will come later. For the moment, this is a standard field, it's a connection of one form, this is a two form. Everything will follow somehow derive from taking the geometrical properties, the transformation properties under arbitrary coordinate transformation, arbitrary diffeomorphism of everything very seriously, very, you know, very orthodox way, almost fanatical way. Nothing will happen which is not well defined abstractly independently of the coordinates. So that's why I insisted this is a one form, this is a two form. That's how they transform it. The two form is obtained by the triad by just dualizing the tensor, the space-time index. So these are the constraints that generate the local SU2 transformation and three-dimensional diffeomorphism. These are, so to say, the fixed time, well, yeah, the fixed time invariances of the theory. And one problem, one way of viewing the problem of the construction of the kinematics is to find a Hilbert space and field operators on which these are realized unitarily. Okay, so we want a representation of an algebra of fields or functions of field, if you want product these groups there. And I think this has already been discussed. With real A and E, this define Euclidean quantum gravity. There are two ways of getting the Lorentzian theory, either taking a complex A and certain reality conditions, or modifying the Hamiltonian constraint by adding a piece, which I've written there. And that's the approach I will focus more, but I will... So A is real in what follows. So that's the classical part, and this is the state space. So one way of starting is to take kind of Schrödinger functionals over the configuration space of the space of the smooth connections, but we want to define these states precisely. So we take a set of functions, which are cylindrical functions. Gamma is a graph embedded in the manifold. S is a function on n copies of the loop, n is the number of links in the graph. This is the holonomy, and that's a function of the holonomies. That's the final function. This is a cylindrical function. In a proper sense, these functions are dense in the continuous functional over smooth connection. So there are many, not a few in this sense. What's good about these functions is that there is a way of defining a scalar product that I believe Abai has discussed in detail about on the infinite dimensional space of these functions here. If one completes in the Hilbert norm, one gets a Hilbert space. Now, why do we like this Hilbert space? First, because the field operators are well defined over it, self-adjoint, and importantly, they're covariant. The definition of field operators transform correctly under diffeomorphism. But more importantly, because this Hilbert space defined here carries a unitary representation of local SU2 and, more interestingly, a unitary representation of this sigma. So in other words, there is a natural action of gauge transformation and diffeomorphism on these states, which just because we know how the connection transforms under one and the other. So there's a linear representation. But what is important is that this scalar product is invariant. If I make a diffeomorphism here and here, this formula is invariant. So this is a unitary. This defines a unitary representation of these two groups here. And last key property of this Hilbert space is that there is a pretty basis, which allows to actually compute stuff, which is the following. I believe Abai has introduced this one as well. It's constructed in terms of spin networks with, to this purpose, the generalization of Roger Penrose's spin network. A spin network here is a graph. These are graphs, again, embedded in the manifold, somewhere in the manifold. Later on, there will be abstract, so to say, spin networks, which are defined up to their embedding. But these are embedded in the manifold. A set of colorings to attached to each link. A coloring is a representation of SU2. And another set of coloring attached to the node. A coloring is a vector in the tensor product of the three representation corresponding, or the representation corresponding to the ones which are attached at the links that arrive at the node. Given this data here, one can construct one of these states by just taking the holonomies, taking them in the representation J, where J is the color associated to the link, and taking all of them together and contracting with all these vectors. And if you think for a moment, all indices match nicely. This is a well-defined number, which is a function of the representation. These vectors here in every node leave an Hilbert space. By choosing an orthonormal basis in each Hilbert space, we get a set of spin networks which form an orthonormal basis in H. If we consider SU2 transformation, gauge transformation, there is an invariant subspace, a proper subspace of H, which is invariant, which is the gauge invariant functionals. And there is a subset of spin networks, which is an orthonormal basis in these SU2 gauge invariant functions by taking invariant vectors here and here. So this is the space, and now the operators. And that will be the theory. So defining space of operator is like defining Fock space and creation annihilation operators, if you want. Now, roughly, we want A to act multiplicatively and E to be a functional derivative so that their commutation is the one we want. These are distributionals, take us out of the Hilbert space. We want to define the well-defined smeared thing, but we want to define them nicely and covariantly. And remembering that this is a one-form and the natural thing to the dual of the space of one form. The natural dual is line, and this is a two-form. Its natural dual is surfaces. We construct operators which are A smeared in one dimension and E smeared in two dimensions, and more precisely, the holonomy of A around a line E will be promoted to an operator, and the integral of these two forms around the surface sigma will be promoted to an operator. That's a key step in the construction of the kinematics of the theory. Now, this is a function of the connection, which of course acts multiplicatively here. This, if you just plug the functional derivative in, you get the action, and that's the only calculation that I'm going to show in this pedagogical lecture, just to give you an idea of how and why things happen. Suppose I have a state, which is the state, the spin network state, defined by a single line here. Okay, so it's the holonomy of the connection along this state contracted with two vectors, one and one. So that's my state. And I want to act with this operator where this is E smeared on a surface. Okay, so what happens, I've just to use all the formulas that were before, plug everything inside, I have a lot of integrals and stuff. The interesting point is that there are two integrals from the integration of the surface, one integral from the integration here. These combine nicely with the delta function of the functional derivative, okay, to give an expression which it's not only covariant, but it's just one or zero. This, in that particular case, is one. It just counts the number of intersections between the. So this is the right Jacobian for transforming this into the proper coordinates in which to integrate the delta. So all this piece here, until here, is zero, and the result is the state we started from with inserted here a tau I. I is the index that's lasted here, a Pauli matrix, the generator of SU2. So this is how these operators on this state have a kind of nice geometrical action that allows everything to be finite and to compute things. So that's the Hilbert space and the operators, and let me just sketch, remind again, this was already done by. Something one can do with that, just at the level of the kinematics, like one can study quantum properties of the angular momentum independently of the dynamics. If I take a particular quantity, which is the area of a certain surface sigma, this is its expression in terms of the metric. If you write in terms of the E, it looks like that. So if I want to write a corresponding operator, I have to transform this into operators. I have to regularize, because this is has to be smeared by itself, and this has to be smeared by itself. So I have to appropriately point split, transform into operators, take the limit. Well, this can be done precisely. One gets to an operator, which is the operator associated to the area of that surface, the quantization of this quantity here. And this is self-adjoint. This is well-defined. It's densely defined in the Hilbert space. And its spectral problem has been completely solved. And what goes on, that's an example, the area acting, the area associated to the surface acting on the spin network, which is this thing here, give the spin network back. So this is a general thing. The spin network states are eigenstates of this operator. Times a number, which is, this is a Planck length square, and a sum of terms, which are the intersections between the surface and the spin network, and for every term, the Casimir of the representation associated to the link. Now, this is not surprising. If you just look at here, there is a tau from one, a tau from the other. That's the quadratic Casimir in SU2, so you get the square root of the Casimir, the identity, so this turns out to be an eigenstate. This is, so to say, the main sequence. There is a second part of the spectrum that has been worked out. The spectrum is completely understood. A similar formula works from the volume, where now, here the area is concentrated on the intersection with a spin network. The volume is concentrated on the nodes. In other words, the volume of the region R gets a contribution for every node of the spin network inside R. So I close this super rapid review of the kinematics with the kind of intuition behind that, and how one reads that after having constructed that. I suppose this is a piece of a spin network, so which is continuing. This is, again, is embedded in the manifold. This is a node, this is another node, this is a link, there are their coloring. So every time I measure the volume around here, I get a contribution, and around here I get a contribution. So roughly, I can think that there is a chunk of volume, a bunch of volume around here, a bunch of volume around here. These two volumes are separated by a surface, and the volume here is determined by the coloring of the node. The color, similar here, the area of the surface is determined by the coloring of the link. So both these volumes are kind of quantized, zero, one quantum, two quantum, and so on. And similar to this area. So one has one derives from this construction an intuition of space-time in which volume is made by bits and areas and something like this.
Do the volumes and areas satisfy the sort of simple example? If you reduce some area to zero, the volumes typically have to go to zero.
In that sense, yes, but not more than that, in the sense that this is not flat space.
Yeah,
so inside the same area, you can put a lot of volume or little volume, of course. There are a lot of flexibility. But there are some minimal obvious things that happen, which is, yeah. Okay, so...
Did you ask if volume goes to zero in the stream?
No, I was asking if there's a definition of a volume operator and a definition of an area operator. So we expect, for example, the area went to zero, the volume went to zero.
Well, for instance, if you have a certain non-zero volume around it, I guess you should you cannot have zero area, right? Things like that, which is true.
No, you could have zero, because now you have the network here and close,
well,
and take the areas around it, and the radius come out and have zero.
Sure, but this is like in generativity. If you have a 3-sphere, you go on the other side, but if you inside there is area. Good, so that's the kinematics, and let me now begin the discussion of the dynamics. And before getting into the dynamics, a small preliminary remark, which is completely trivial, but somehow if one doesn't have it in mind exactly, one misses all the construction and everything seems strange. So again, this is completely trivial. And the point is that if you have a constraint associated to a gauge invariance where the gauge group has infinite volume, then the gauge invariant states have infinite norm in the natural Hilbert space, the unconstrained Hilbert space, if you put a scalar product up there. So let me do that. Let me just make an example which makes things clear. I have a quantum mechanics of two degrees of freedom, and suppose I have a constraint which is just translation in one, so this is a quantum constraint. Of course, the gauge invariant states are the states that do not depend on y, which are states that do not live in this Hilbert space there, which I may have wanted in order to define self-adjoint x and y, px and py there, and be sure I was doing things properly up there. So if I am in this situation, well, everybody knows what to do. There are many ways of thinking about that. One way of thinking about that is that we're actually looking for generalized states that solve this constraint here. So we want this to be part of the game. So a common thing to do is to take a subspace, say Schwarz space, smooth, rapid decrease, compact support functions, and the dual, and we want to look for solutions here. Now, looking for solution here, that's what I want to stress. The operators are well defined here by duality. This phi is in the dual space, and psi is in the here. So the operator here is defined in that way, right? So saying that a state here solves the constraint means that its action on any state acted upon by the constraint is zero, which is the formula that we use in a moment, both for the, well, particularly for the diffeomorphic constraint, but then also for the Hamiltonian constraint. Yeah, for both. So, what about the diffeomorphic constraint? There is, I said, a natural unitary representation of the diffeomorphic group. Phi is a diffeomorphism that acts on the state, and it acts.
Just to make sure I understand, the diffeomorphism acts on your state network as well as the gauge field?
Yeah, that's a small, no, not as well. That's a small calculation from the definition of the diffeomorphisms are defined by acting on the states in the way you would think about. So you take A, you make a finite diffeomorphism inside here, so you get a linear action on the side. So that's the definition.
You're not moving, I mean, if you move them both, then it would be a very sort of trivial.
Trivially, right, right. No, no, you move just...
Just the A.
Yeah, that's the no spin network so far. That's, okay, this is just the action of the diffeomorphism here.
Okay,
so this is a functional of the field.
Right.
I know how the field transform. Wait.
The next line, you have psi with both a gamma and an A. So those states are depending on the spin network, right?
Yeah, but if you don't understand it here, you define the actual diffeomorphism here first. So now we know how any state transforms. Okay, period. Now I take these states here, or those states here. Let's just take those. So I want that action. I want A to transform. Okay, and this gives a transformation. And a very simple calculation that you can do in your mind looking at the formula tells you that this action is equivalent to, I mean, if I take a finite diffeomorphism and act here, the result I get is a state in which this S is moved somewhere else, which is what you were pointing out. If I now use this as my basis of state, the action of diffeomorphism on this basis of state, take the spin network and move them around. And this is exactly what is written here. The diffeomorphism act on the spin network, move them around, and that's the action of that.
If you're going to be working with the members of the dual space, are you going to give up talking about your product?
No. I'll get there in a moment. I'll get there in the next... Absolutely, absolutely. And there is a number, absolutely. And there is a number of techniques to bring the inner product to the space of the solutions. I will mention one in the next transparency. This is one of the subjects in which a lot of work has been done about 3 or 4 years ago, and this is one of the subjects most under control in this case. So I'll get there in a moment. So now I want to find a solution in the dual. So I want to find a phi in the dual such that when I act here, I get back itself. In other words, such that its value on a spin network is the same on the moved spin network. And the general solution of that equation was is known and is easy and was found some time ago and is constructed as follows. First, I need a definition. I define this object little s, the s naught. I'm sorry for the little s that looks too much like the big S in my notation, which are equivalent class of spin networks under diffeomorphism. So these are objects now that don't live in the manifold anymore. It's just the upset knot with its knotting and its coloring. Or sometimes I call them, or are called them, abstract spin networks. I like the expression S naught, but I seem to be the only one using it. So given one of these S naughts or abstract spin networks, I define a dual state to be 0, 1, accordingly whether this embedded spin network belongs to these equivalent classes or not. And these are all the solutions of the previous equation. Good. So what about the inner product there? Well, there is a number of ways of constructing the inner product. One is this group integration techniques that Marles, I guess, has in this context discussed a lot. Can I finish the the simplest way I know for that kind of follow from that construction to fix the inner product there is the following, namely to take in the Hilbert state we started from any diffeomorphic invariant operator, so any operator which is invariant under the action of diffeomorphism, and require that this operator is well defined as a linear operator on the Hilbert space of the solution, requiring that it be self-adjoint on this linear space of solution, fixes a normalization and and therefore defines a Hilbert product here. So in other words, there's a unique Hilbert product which has this property. And what it comes out to be is basically that these states are orthogonal to each other, but they are not normalized. There is a factor here, there's an integer factor, which is related to the number of discrete symmetries of the graph that can be obtained by a diffeomorphism, which is a factor that was missed by Lee and myself long ago, and it can be computed using this technique. Yes?
Oh, yes.
Well, strictly speaking, might want to add that what you require is that all of the self-adjoint different-variant operators be, all the operators that are self-adjoint in the original program
are
still self-adjoint in the final.
Yeah, thanks.
What would happen if you tried to do this?
It would work.
So what are the states and how are they formalized?
Well,
sure.
You would get L2 of little r. You get the integral just in dx.
Just in one.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you think for a while, you want x and px to be self-adjoint on the space of functions that don't depend on y, right? So they're self-adjoint. That's how you fix the thing. Okay, so that's the solution of the diffeomorphism constraint, or a little bit space of solutions. What about the physical interpretation? I want to stress that, because I think that's, from the physical point of view, I will not talk very much physical, I'll talk more, but from the physical point of view, this is a key point, at least to me. So now the states are spin networks, which are abstract, they don't sit somewhere, okay? Still, we can think that each node represents a chunk of volume, and each line represents a chunk of surface here, transversal to it, which are quantized. There are certain eigenvalues that they can take. The difference between before is that these are not embedded. So the location of these things is not relevant. These are not sitting into a space. They are not in a space. So these are not quantum excitation in space. If you want, they are quantum excitation of space. That's space. Right? Space is made by this quanta of things over which, if you want, the rest of physics may happen. And that's a essential physical difference between these things talked at loops or at strings. Strings sit somewhere. I move it as a different string. At least, yeah.
Sorry, just a simple question. So at the beginning we're thinking about these silver strings as functions of connections. And the spin network, I thought, was just a convenient way of labeling a basis, because given a spin network, we still have our sort of functions of connections, and for every connection we can compute the holonomy, etc., and we get our answer. But now, what happens to the connections?
Oh, it's like a Fourier transform. You have a basis of states that depend on k, and then you expand in that basis, and your basis are just, and your states are just linear combination of psi k, and x is still there, but it's just that's the original idea. I mean, so the loops are the Fourier components of the function of the connections. Okay, so that's the diffeomorphism constraint. That's everything I wanted to say. And let me come to the Hamiltonian constraint. I want to not just write a definition there, but try to give an idea of what are the relevant points here in the Hamiltonian constraint, which is a little bit at the core of everything. So let me just go through the historical path that led to the Hamiltonian constraint, which is now mostly studied and considered, also because I believe it started in Santa Barbara. Ted may tell me if it started here, right? 13 years ago, and I have the copies of the transparencies of the talks of your guys. So be careful, because I could show everybody what you were claiming. Ted Jacobson and Lee realized that if you take the variables that Debye was just teaching everybody 13 years ago, and you do a quantization on the lattice, you do a kind of Wilson-Kogut quantization, then the Wilson loop, the Wilson-Kogut state, if they don't intersect, they are a solution of what you would write as the obvious quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint.
Actually, the big insight is working with Paul Hanson on the lattice. The big insight was to get off the lattice, and then it still works.
Yeah.
That was it still works even off the lattice.
Yeah. So that was after, or that before?
That was
maybe I should put rental name or so. So I was not born yet. Can I tell the story? I sent a letter to Gary asking whether I could come to this 86, and I get a reply, no, sorry. But then I
sent the letter before you were born.
All right. Okay. So then somehow the solutions were taken to the continuum, and the idea was, well, there was all this loop representation, the first version of the loop representation construction. And what we did at the time was to construct the thorough regularization procedure, the Hamiltonian constraint, and still there were exact solutions for all loops that were not self-intersecting. So in the spin network language, spin network state is just a linear combination of product of loop state. The spin network language is a spin network with no nodes. So let me illustrate what goes on. First, the heuristic of what is going on that maybe you have seen already. The Hamiltonian constraint is just the curvature of the connection EE. This EE I've shown you in the little calculation before. I don't know if I've actually done it, but believe me. When acting on a function of the connection, which is just a line, it brings down the tangent of the line at that point. So if you act with Hamiltonian constraints, which depend on a point, in this point here, you get one tangent and then another tangent. So this term is always symmetric. This anti-symmetric, you get zero. But if you act on an intersection, you have a term which has one tangent here, you get something non-zero. So the action of the Hamiltonian constraint gets concentrated on the nodes. And this will continue to happen all the way through in more and more precise definition of the Hamiltonian. Now, this is any sort of infinity hidden here. This is very, very imprecise. So what we did at the time was to regularize this thing here. And the regularization has two parts. EE is two distribution, one has two points split them. And S is the curvature, but we don't have the holonomy operator. We don't have the connection operator. We have the operator corresponding to holonomy. So one has to express S in terms of holonomies, and of course there is a natural way of doing that, because if you take a small loop and you take the radius small, the holonomy around the loop is just roughly 1 plus a term in the curvature in the plane of the loop plus higher order terms in the radius. So this is how the operator was constructed, and the problem and the good result was that there were this infinite set of solutions. But the problem, and that what made people unhappy for a while, and that was what was not totally convincing in this construction, that this is an operator which is zero on what we call the solutions and diverges elsewhere. So there were a number of other solutions with a particular linear combination of things with intersection that were studied. But this was always in this context in which the operator is divergent when it's not zero. And it's not a well-defined operator in the Hilbert space, the Hamiltonian constraint. Then somehow, things an insight came several years later in a different context, namely not study the Hamiltonian constraint itself, but study the Hamiltonian proper in a theory with matter. You take the generativity plus a scalar field, and then you use the equal value surface of the scalar field as time, this internal time kind of ideas. And then you have an Hamiltonian that evolves there, which this is a Hamiltonian constraint with a scalar field. This is a momentum. If you think for a moment, the Hamiltonian turned out to be the square root of the Hamiltonian constraint integrated in this space. Now, at that point, if one takes the operator there, the Hamiltonian constraint, one does the full regularization procedure on this thing here, the three-dimensional integral of the square root, then H turned out to be finite. There's no this divergence here. So that was great. There was an indication that there is a way of defining this thing finite. And what was the reason? The reasons are two. And these are the two reasons at the core of the, as far as I understand it, at the core of the non-perturbative diffeomorphic current dynamics. First is that this is a free form, because E is a density. This is a density. So when you take the product of these two, it's a double density. And we are fanatic about covariance, right? Double densities are not something you can properly integrate in space. But if you take the square root, it's a single density. So it's a three form. So it's something that you can integrate in space. So that's good from the point of view of general covariance, first. And the second point is that this convergence that I'm talking about comes on diffeomorphic invariant states. And let me illustrate that, because it's also the core of the all later constructions. The point, as I said, is that here there is 2e that gives to roughly 2 tangents, and there is the curvature. And the curvature is obtained by regularizing it with some kind of little loop, and then studying what happens when epsilon goes to 0. Now this is a state on which I have acted. But remember that I want to study this, the solution I want to find, I'm in the dual, and I want state in the dual such that when acting here I get 0. So what I have to study is how a state in the dual behaves in the limit when epsilon goes to 0, when h epsilon goes here. But the solutions I'm interested in are diffeomorphic invariant states. But if c is a diffeomorphic invariant state, it does not know anything about which element in a diffeomorphic invariant class this lives inside. Therefore, when I shrink this epsilon to 0, for epsilon sufficiently small for not crossing other stuff, the diffeomorphic invariant class of this object does not change. Right? That's a key point. That's a central point for it. Therefore, this thing is independent from epsilon when this thing here is independent from epsilon when epsilon is smaller than a certain epsilon 0. If you take the spin network with this loop attached, if you want. Yeah. If you make epsilon smaller, it's a different spin network, but the two are in the same equivalent class under diffeomorphism.
But I guess maybe there is saying that you have the original spin network and you have a new one instead of that.
Yeah.
Two are different from each other.
These are different from each other. Now, what are in the same equivalent class for epsilon and epsilon prime? So there's a certain point when you take the limit as the cutoff shrinks, that the sequence start to be constant.
I'm getting confused about A again. So I thought in the diffeomorphism invariant class we were sort of thinking about just this representation of this spin network, abstract spin network.
Yeah.
But now you want to put F in there, and that's totally different.
F is an operator which attached F is an operator that attached this little loop. Well, I'm skipping a lot of details here.
One thing might be useful. Yeah. So to think of this as all these functions of connection as being sort of a bar, I mean, text on the right hand side or the thing. And now, however, as you pointed out from this example of simple constraint system, you don't expect solutions of the constraint to lie in that kind of a space. So you're looking at this space of distributions. Mm-hmm. So the space of distributions gather on the functions of connections and give you a number. So you can write down this F, for example, regularized as an operator on the case. Okay. And then it's perfectly well defined. Mm-hmm. But by duality, you can just take its action on the branch. And on the branch line, what it does is just like that. So this is going on between rather take all along here. So when it is convenient, you think of it in terms of, I mean, you can do it very systematically, but
yeah, I'm actually.
Logical purposes, when it is convenient, you think in terms of the connections, and then you want to write broad pictures or something, you think of it in the dual states, which is really the diffeomorphism invariant sorts of distributions.
Let's just say in a more naive way, so if you have a momentum representation, and X is represented naively by d by dx, but now you've represented that explicitly by writing the derivative as x plus epsilon, function of x plus epsilon minus x over epsilon. And now you're studying the derivative when epsilon, the limit when epsilon goes to 0, and something new happens because you're in the space of diffeomorphism.
Okay, so.
You're not saying that it's
strictly independent of epsilon. It's strictly independent of epsilon for epsilon smaller. I'm getting a moment. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yes, absolutely. I'm going to answer in the second part. If I take a one-parameter family,
Take a one-parameter family, it doesn't intersect.
Right.
Tangent.
Right. Okay.
Smooth.
Right. So let me. That's the next comment that was coming here. So here, what I was saying that I have a one parameter, I take a circle that shrinks down, and what I obtain is that this limit it turns out to be well defined. And the reason it turns out to be well defined is because this quantity it's independent of epsilon for epsilon sufficiently small. So that's the good news. However, there is a less satisfactory aspect of all that, which is the following. This loop was constructed as a regularization of the F. F just as a first term expansion of the monomy of a closed loop. Now, of course, this can be done in a number of ways. I can take a circle, I can take a something with a point, I can take something that runs along the line, I can take any sort of things. So I can choose a regularization prescription, a sequence of a family of loops, a one-parameter family of loops that converges to what I want. I have a lot of constraints. I want the regularization prescription to be such, this family of loops to be such, that at the end of the day I get something well-defined. I get the long list of things that... But still, clearly there are many things that I can do. Okay? So there is a large ambiguity in the construction of this object here. And what we chose at the time, after many nights of wandering, was just a triangular loop with this shape here, basically because it was the only thing that we found that satisfied all the... that at the end of the day gave a diffeomorphic invariant operators, but not in any sense thinking that this is the only possible regularization. Well, careful. Yeah. The precise length of this, the precise shape of this line, become all irrelevant in this formula here, which is the only that counts, because this is a quantity that depends only on the diffeomorphism class of whatever is inside here. So the prescription has to be up to diffeomorphism. I can take this line and wiggle around. It's the same in this context. It's the same. Of course, this in which I run around this line and then close and that is different from that in which I don't run around anything, because there is no diffeomorphism that connects these two. So this is a different thing than this one. From this one.
On the face of it, it looks bizarre because you're taking the limit as epsilon goes to zero of something that doesn't seem to have any dependence on epsilon and is completely different than the zero thing. So why should the limit as epsilon goes to zero of this have anything to do with what you started with?
Well, the limit, because that's what the limit is. The limit is not the value. The limit of f of x as x goes to 0 is not f of 0, right? It's this discontinuous function.
But it also, from reading what you were saying, it also sounds like it doesn't have much of any dependence on epsilon at all. So that's almost like saying I'm going to define the step function for x greater than 0 to be the step function for x less than 0.
I'm not sure I understood that, but the...
This is not a description of an integral.
Yeah, yeah.
And also it's a description. I mean, there's no analog of the diffeomorphism in the invariant state, like in the step function thing. Here, the whole thing is happening because it's not true that a channel, epsilon operating on psi, is epsilon independent. That connection state is absolutely epsilon independent.
Uh-huh.
But physically, what interests us is not that.
But
phi, which happens to teach him all the back.
Okay.
Yeah.
That result is different.
Okay. So with this choice, the action of the Hamiltonian turn out to be a sum of terms that act on all the vertices, and what it does is basically add a line, or if you want, open up a vertex and three vertices in that in this form, multiplied by coefficients which are finite and computable. It's just some algebra. These coefficients depend only on the colorings on the representation, which are sitting here, 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 and inside. So that was good, but of course was in a very unphysical and ugly context with a scalar field, a Hamiltonian, was very far from just clean GR. And then in 96 came Thomas Thiemann, in which somehow bringing everything together and adding some a number of remarkable ideas, was able to construct a well-defined, finite Hamiltonian constraint operator. So, what does...
So now we are just backing them over to the no scalar field.
There's no scalar field, yeah, thanks. There's no scalar field. This is pure generativity, and that's the construction of the operator corresponding to the Hamiltonian constraint. So first of all, what Thomas said is, well, we want a density. This is a double density, so let's define by the determinant of Q, so we get a single density. Now this is a ugly, the three-dimensional matrix, if you want, E square. Now this is an horrible quantity to work with, but it has a cute property, which is the Poisson bracket of the volume with a connection. This is a dependence on x here, sits here. This is the volume of any region that contains this point x. So now what Thomas argues is that, well, suppose I'm in quantum mechanics. I have the x operator and the Hamiltonian, and I want to define the p operator. P is just the Poisson bracket, am I getting this right, of the Hamiltonian with the x. So the p operator is just a commutator of the Hamiltonian operator with the x operator. Okay, so we have an operator corresponding to that. We have more or less an operator corresponding to that. So let's just define this quantum operator as the commutator of this operator, this operator. Of course, we don't really have an operator corresponding to the connection, so we have to again regularize in terms of a holonomy. But this can be done. There are a lot of boring technicalities. I'm not skipping the things which are not relevant here. The point is the following. I can write the Hamiltonian using in this form, replacing this with this. This is nice and cute form here, where this is a free form now. It's something I can nicely integrate if I want. And this is a Poisson bracket. I just regularize it by replacing S again with a holonomy around a closed circle, and I put A, I take the holonomy along a certain line. There's a lot of technicalities, but at the end of the day, there is a well-defined operator, which is just obtained by the volume operator, which I said was well-defined, and this commutator here, and a bunch of holonomies. Again, for the reasons discussed before, when I take the limit as the regulators, the regulator here is the size of this thing, that goes to zero of a diffeomorphic invariant state and the Hamiltonian acting on any spin network state, I get a quantity which is finite. So I keep track of all the epsilons, the dependence of things. It's finite and it's well defined. It's covariantly defined. And what it is basically of the form that was discussed before. So acting on a S not state. This is a diffeomorphic invariant state which depend on some spin network which is not sitting anywhere. Okay, gives a sum of terms, and the sum of each one of the sum of terms act on one of the nodes here and opens up the nodes in three. And there are some coefficients which are finite and computable which depend on all the colorings. So it's just a function of a bunch of half integers and things like that. So let me summarize and then comment on the various on the goods and the bads of this picture. There is a Hilbert space with a basis of spin network. There are basic operators. There is the local SU2 and diffeomorphism implemented unitarily. One can solve the invariant state in the appropriate sense and have the space of diffeomorphic invariant state over which it is defined an operator which is finite and well defined. So this gives a general covariant background dependent definition of a four-dimensional quantum field theory.
The solutions of the simultaneous constraint must involve an infinite number of vertices?
No. Might.
You said I take each vertex and basically open it up, so you add a few more vertices.
Yes.
Generic, presumably,
yes. Yeah.
And you can write down combinatorial. This is technical detail, but you can write down infinite sets of solutions and see how they're playing with
so explicit solutions are known as this Hamiltonian.
Well,
what?
But in fact, the dual features of Hamiltonian remove this stuff. So is it not that there is no edge which could have been added by Hamiltonian, then it's a melee.
Well, let me just stay on the general picture before getting into the So I want to make a number of general comments, some kind of positive and some negatives, just to point out what I think are the goods and the bads of this picture. First of all, consistency. Are there anomalies? This is the classical Poisson algebra. The part which involves the diffeomorphism and the diffeomorphism of the Newtonian is appropriately realized without anomalies in the quantum theory. The Hamiltonian-Hamiltonian constraint, which is a diffeomorphism in the classical theory, the commutator here gives zero. I will comment about this zero in the next transparency. At the level of consistency, this just guarantees that the everything which is defined here is consistent in the sense that there's no anomaly that kills it. Matter extension have been studied, Young-Mills and Scalar field. I'm not sure about the state of the fermion thing. And it's much more complicated, but it's conceptually exactly the same. The Lorentzian part of the constraint has been constructed exactly using the same techniques. Just more complicated and a lot of indices and equations. So, comments. First a positive comment and then a negative comment. Positive comment is, how is it possible? Are we really claiming here that there is a well-defined four-dimensional quantum field theory defined in the background-independent way? Well, I just want to make, how is it possible? And in particular, one could couple Young-Mills theory to that, right? And one can show is that it's still finite. So is there an intuition telling us what is going on? This is a small argument, due to Thomas again, that suggests how the infinities come in. This is the Hamiltonian of Young-Mills, just the electric part. So that's the electric part of the Young-Mills Hamiltonian. Of course, as you all know, if you just take the product of these two operators, this is divergent because there is there are two delta functions here, and there is a divergence proportional to, if you want, 1 over epsilon cube, you see the cut off of the length of the dimension of a length. However, if you now remember that this is general relativity, if you write your metric properly, you need AB, the metric here, plus this is a density, this is a density, so that the thing which is well-defined is divided by the square root of the determinant of the metric. Now, if you have this expression, you can do two ways. You can take this as a background, fix it, and then you go up this path, or you can consider this as an operator. If this is an operator, and if you use the techniques described before, this is an operator which is depends on the cutoff in that way, but this is an operator which depends on the cutoff in the opposite way. And why? Because this is a density, this is a density, this is an inverse density. Right? And so this, in the limit, goes exactly to something which is finite. In other words, strictly imposing general covariance restricts us to considering only operators whose dependence on the cutoff is the correct one when we take the limit. If you want the most optimistic scenario, this is an implementation of the old idea driving all that, which is that there is no short distance here. There are no high frequency modes because the distance is quantized at short scale. I mean, we're not moving, only moving step by step, so to say. Okay, now what are the problems? First is that suppose this is a correct definition of quantum gravity. So what? It's defined very much non-perturbatively in closed form. It's a Hamiltonian constraint up there. How do we compute stuff? And there is a remarkable lack of computation techniques. And in the last part of the talk, will be the next 10 minutes, I will just talk about spin forms as one way of addressing that. But the canonical theory, it's very hard to extract physics out of that.
There's also, just to clarify, I mean, there is a period
The distance between what I would like to compute and what I know how to do is too far.
But there are a number of things. I mean, for example, you could compute the volume of the universe and the evolution of time. But there are things. There are nothing to compute to worry about the next point.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
What was the issue about the inner product? I thought you had the inner product.
No, the inner product and the level of emotion constraint.
Oh, I see.
There's one other step. We have a recipe, but we don't have the implementation.
Yes,
but one can find in infinite classes of solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint, which are normalizable under that inner product. But one wonders whether there might be others, but because of the problem, the next point.
So, second worry. There have been a number of fears in the community connected to two points. First, as I said, the Hamiltonian constraint is not here in the classical theory. You have something which depends on the diffeomorphism constraint. In the quantum theory, you get zero. Now, at first sight, this is okay because this is only defined on diffeomorphism invariant state. So, of course, this is a diffeomorphism constraint. You get zero. But then you look a little more carefully. And you define, and you discover that in order to define this commutator, one has to actually go a little bit outside the space of diffeomorphism invariant state. One can extend this operator to non-diffeomorphism invariant states. This has been done by these people. And you expect that by going to this bigger space of non-diffeomorphism invariant state, you see what happens here, and you still get zero. So you always get zero there. So you seem to be getting zero too much.
Usually, one has to be a fear of non-commutation.
Yes, absolutely, and that's usually my answer. This is what does this mean? Of course, this is not going to disrupt the consistency of the theory, but what people suggest might mean is that perhaps the classical limit is going wrong here. I'll leave it open. There is a lot of discussion about that. Second. Lee has been arguing at length that this particular action of the Hamiltonian constraint, which act on the vertex and doing stuff around, is in some sense too local. If you have a big state, a big spin network, and you keep acting with Hamiltonian constraint, somehow things far away don't seem to mix sufficiently. And we don't have enough intuition to kind of make that completely rigorous, but it seems that this particular action of the Hamiltonian constraint may not give a kind of long distance propagation that we want in the classical limit. However, of course, the fourth worry, which to me is the serious worry, most serious worries at all, is at the same time an answer to this and a reformulation of this problem and the serious and a problem by itself. Namely, as I said, in this construction, there are a lot of things that has to go to the end, but there's no uniqueness result of any sort. And indeed, variants of this Hamiltonian has been considered of various kinds. So the question is that, is this particular Hamiltonian that has been defined, does it give the correct classical limit, or is there a modification of that Hamiltonian that gives the classical limit, or not at all?
So maybe it's worth mentioning, as you said, there are variants have been defined. There are various ambiguities you mentioned in the Riemann description. But if it isn't the choice of those ambiguities, if you look at all of the actual descriptions that have been written down, they all have the same zero.
There are some that have non-zero but are bad on the other side.
That's right.
Yeah, you can modify it so that you lose it on the other
side.
Right.
But not the first ambiguity is actually pointed out, but modify it further, you can lose it on the other side.
Okay, so this is the state, as far as I understand it, of the... This is the state of the dynamics, as I understand it. Now, the last part, the fourth... subject, I want to describe this recent work of many people's spin-form models, which is a way of taking this dynamics, defined by the Hamiltonian constraint or something else, and study and try to understand it better physically, and perhaps even modify the Hamiltonian or something like that. So I give there are many ways of approaching the subject. I give you the way that I understand it better. So roughly, and here I will be much more sketchy than up to now, we have a space of diffeomorphism invariant state, out of which we want to find the space of physical states, which are the solution of Hamiltonian constraint. And let me think that there is a projector that, given a state here, projects on the solution of this constraint. Now, formally, I can write this projector this way. This is a kind of expression that energy physicists don't know well, right? If you take the delta function, you can represent it as the integral of exponential. This is the delta function on the h. Now let me take this expression seriously as it is, expand it, there is a way of giving meaning precisely to these integrals and actually performing them. So I can write, this is all formal manipulations, of course, I will get to an expression at the end. There is a way of writing the matrix elements of the propagator, of the projector, between two diffeomorphic invariant states, two abstract spin networks, two S-naughts, as a certain expansion, in which I have one actual Hamiltonian, two actual Hamiltonian, and so on. So why I like this expansion? Because I can somehow follow Feynman and associate a graphical representation of this expansion. So the first term is non-zero only if S is equal to S prime. So suppose this is S, my initial spin network. This is S prime, which is equal. And I draw this term as the wall sheet of the spin network moving up in time, right? A cylinder with a wall inside in that particular case. The second term is the same. But now there is an actual Hamiltonian constraint. I remind you that the action of this particular Hamiltonian constraint is that. So the spin network evolves up in time at a certain point. The Hamiltonian constraint acts here and opens this up in 3. Okay, so here I have a surface, a number of surfaces that meet at these lines, and this line in turn meets at this branching point, which I call vertex, which is where the actual Hamiltonian constraint is. And the elementary vertex, therefore, the vertex defined by this Hamiltonian is this one, right? So it's just like a node that opens up in 3. So there are these 3 new little surfaces being created. Each surface has a color, a representation, which is because it's generated by the spin network. There was a color associated here. So this is a second order term, and so on and so forth. One can do that precisely. T. No. Well, because I skipped a chapter. You're right, but I skipped a section. If you look at this, here I have a vertex, which is the inverse of that vertex here. I skipped the symmetrization of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian I'm talking about here is actually the previous one symmetrized. So there is an action, there is a T reversed action of it as well. You catch something that I slide over and I hid from them. So the matrix element of the propagator, which you can think at intuitively as the Hawkins path integral over 2-3 geometries, can be expressed as actually the first talk about this stuff was in this room, I believe, in when you invited me a number of years ago. This was the can be expressed as a sum over pictures of this kind, which are surfaces, and these surfaces are not embedded anywhere, right? In the sense that if I smoothly move them at the same surface, so it's the topological surface, not which branch and are colored with this half integers, and each term it's a number of the C coefficients, which were just one per each vertex. So it's a product of the vertex of an amplitude of the vertex. The amplitude of the vertex is just a sum. It's just a simple function of the colorings around. So what's colored here are the surfaces and the edges, because in the spin network was the links and the nodes which were colored. So this is a nice representation of the covariant formulation of the theory, which somehow gives us an intuition about the four-dimensional space-time being described here. But I think there are two reasons of interest in particular, which is this transparency and the next one, which will be the last before the conclusions, which is that peculiar picture of a four-dimensional quantum field theory defined as sum of surfaces is precisely the same picture that one gets from a path that starts from topological quantum field theory. So, which I'll describe here. Now, let me start by an observation which I think is important. As far as the properties and the covariance are concerned, a field theory can be of three kinds. Can be a field theory in a background, like QED. There's a background of an infinite number of degrees of freedom. can be a topological field theory, like the F theory. There's no background, there is a finite number of degrees of freedom, and there are no local degrees of freedom, in the sense there are no waves, right? And the few degrees of freedoms that are there, they cannot be localized. They're just, when you go around a loop, a non-contractible loop in the manifold, you compute something. But general relativity, it's neither topological nor on a background. It's diffeomorphic invariant, so there's no background, but there's an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And there are local degrees of freedom in the sense that there are gravitational waves. You're spending millions of dollars to find them. But the theory is invariant under diffeomorphism. So a given degree of freedom cannot be localized on the manifold, right? What is relevant is the localization thing one respect to the other, not the localization thing in the manifold. So this is, I think, it's I believe that there is often a source of confusion between the position of generativity in this. So it's generativity is not topological quantum theory, but nevertheless it's background independent. So having said that, put it on a side, we'll come back in a moment. Let me remind you of a couple of things. Topological quantum field theory can be constructed in a number of ways. One is combinatorial. And the prototype of the combinatorial quantum field theory is this celebrated model in three dimensions by Tuarez at zero, which is obtained by taking three-dimensional manifold, fixing a triangulation, coloring the edge of the triangulation with representations of the quantum group, C2Q, and then defining a partition function which is a sum of all the possible colorings of the product of each tetrahedron of the triangulation of the 6J symbol of that particular tetrahedron. If you formally take Q going to infinity as the quantum group going to SU2, you get exactly the Ponsano-Regge quantization of generativity, the three-dimensional generativity of the 60s, I believe, or something like that. Now, you can do the same in four dimensions, and this was done by Oguri and Crane-Yetter. And then you have a triangulation of a four-dimensional manifold. Here you have a four simplices. And what is interesting is that you have to color the faces and the tetrahedra. Right? Formally, if you take the quantum group going to group limit, you get something which is you can derive formally as the quantization of a topological field theory, which is BF theory. Good, so that's fact. What has this to do with GR? Well, GR can be written, this has been observed by many people as kind of an idea that was going around a lot in the community, as a BF theory for the SO4 group, plus a constraint. And the constraint is that the B field, which is a two form in the Lie algebra of the group, is actually the product of two one forms. What Barrett and Crane have done is to, so there's an actual idea here. Take BF quantum BF theory, impose this constraint, and hope to get quantum GR. What Barrett and Crane have done, they've done so this, or at least an attempt to do that. They've discovered, they've observed that this constraint here that makes BF into GR has a very nice geometrical interpretation. B in the discrete theory is associated to the faces, and if it is of that form, which means that there's an E and an E here that generate it, then it is in its IJ indices is a B vector which is simple, which has a particular property which is this, which is called simple. There's a natural quantization of that, which is to take the representation J associated to the face as a simple representation, which has the same name, which is one of the quantization of the other one. A simple representation of SO4. The representation of SO4 are labeled by two half integers. When they are equal, this representation is simple. I don't believe that this, what I've said, is very clear, but the point is that this constraint can be implemented by restricting the representations here, the coloring, to the simple ones, plus some details. So Barrett and Crane define a model which is somehow BF plus this constraint, which is the sum of the colorings, but simple, of the same expression for BF, with the hope that this is quantum GR. And there is a good news and a bad news. The good news is that there is some formal sense in which this expression, in some limit, goes to the action of generativity, the Hilbert action. The bad news, or the interesting news, is that this is a topological theory. So this did not depend on the triangulation. This, of course, is not a topological theory, nor it has to be a topological theory, and it does depend on the triangulation. So to get something physically meaningful and mathematically non-meaningful, one has to sum over the possible triangulations. So what has to all to do with spin forms? Well, that's kind of, when I saw this, I found it was kind of magic. Take the Barrett-Crane triangulation and go to the dual. Represent it in the dual. So the green is the triangulation, the red is the dual, that's in four dimensions. And rewrite their expression in the dual. So what is colored here, before were edges and tetrahedra, now is surfaces and edges. The dual of a... And the product is not over four simplices, but is over the vertices. What matters here is only the two and one dimensional thing. So you just have to sum over possible surfaces that branch and meet at vertices of the product of the sum of the coloring of the product of the vertices. This is precisely the expression that was three transparencies ago obtained from exponentiating loop quantum gravity. So there is exponentiating the Hamiltonian constraint of canonical quantum gravity. So one gets exactly to the same picture from these completely two different roots. By precisely I mean that this sum is the same, this sum is the same, the power of the vertex is the same. The kind of coloring is the same, okay? And the structure of the dynamics are the same. The vertex, okay, the value of the vertex is different. And the value of the vertex, the possible values of the vertices, correspond to all to possible Hamiltonians, that the possible variants of the Hamiltonian that I can define. Okay? So the same class of theory, not the same specific model. But now, the convergence is even stronger than that, because... let's see if I can say that, you know...
One set of vertices, for example, corresponds to the Kiemann Hamiltonian.
Yes, precisely, which has been written down. now, the correspondence is more stronger than that, because let me take a Barrett-Crane triangulation.
Is the simplicity of the representation being enforced because you're getting it from three dimensions instead of four?
Because there's SU2 there.
Yeah.
SU2 is just, the two J are equal, so I represent the two J as a single J.
Which
sounds like the core of Abai, classical formulation of the self-dual, anti-self-dual, which one of the two is sufficient to, you can mix the self-dual part of the Lorentz group with a T equals zero, three-dimensional notation.
Stop. Perhaps you can work that relation out in detail. Actually, we'll probably hear more about it.
Yeah, let me just. I want to conclude because this transparency is the next, and then I summarize. So, what I'm trying to say is that the convergence is even stronger than that. David, is your name the next transparency? You miss your name. Oh, come on, say for what your name is. So the second reason, you see, that your name is the name of the director. I made all this effort to put it. So the second reason, this is very recent work. The second reason of interest of this spin form model is the following. There were the two-dimensional matrix models of quantum gravity that raised some interest some time ago, which actually have the origin of the path that led Oguri to construct this Crane-Yetter-Oguri model, this quantum BF theory. What Oguri did was just generalize to four dimension a construction by Bulatov in three dimension, which was a generalization of the two-dimensional matrix models. What happened in these models is extremely interesting. You have a quantum theory of a matrix. You make the Feynman expansion of it, and the Feynman graphs are the triangulations of a surface. So summing over the triangulation of the surface doing two-dimensional quantum gravity, it's like doing the Feynman expansion of one of these matrix models. Now, the same work in four dimensions for this... there's a theory written by Oguri such that its Feynman graphs give the Barrett-Yetter manifold invariance. And surprisingly, using an observation by Kirill and Lorraine Friedel, one can do the same for the Barrett-Crane theory. Namely, there exists a field theory, which I've written here. So it's a theory over four copies of S3, of the three sphere. With this action, the very simple action, which is no derivative terms, which is no local, such that if I do a mode expansion, and that's what generates the J's, the representation, and so on, and I write all the Feynman expansion here, its Feynman expansion is precisely the Barrett-Crane model. So this suggests that from this particular point of view, I can view this triangulated colored space-time, this quantum geometry, as one of the Feynman graphs in the expansion of this theory here. Just wanted to mention this because I guess is the last step in a remarkable set of convergences between these four-dimensional representation of diffeomorphously invariant quantum field theories. I may conclude because I've gone on very long, and then the question. So I just 4 points I've made. First, I want to insist on that. There exists a four-dimensional, background-independent, non-perturbative, finite definition, closed form, of a quantum theory of general relativity. The key problems I see them is how to compute things, whether it is the right classical limit, and whether it's the right definition of the Hamiltonian. There is a way of thinking about this problem, which is and getting a physical insight in the physics of the theory by going to a Feynman-like, a covariant formalism. And this is a spin form formalism in which the sum is over diffeomorphism equivalent, topologically inequivalent, two-dimensional branched surfaces colored with representations, and the amplitude is just a product on all the vertices. And finally, the last point is that these spin forms are related, strictly related to topological quantum field theory, and can be viewed as a four-dimensional generalization of the matrix models of two-dimensional quantum gravity. And I'll stop here. Yes?
I don't understand what happened when we went from a delta function representation of the constraint to some dynamical, somehow time slipped in and suddenly we're talking about dynamics. What happened there?
It happened, yeah, it's a good question. What happened is that there is a fictitious parameter that comes into the theory, which is precisely, if you want, the role of the fictitious parameter, which in classical generativity the coordinate time has. In other words, what I wanted to compute is, I was very fast there, it's just that I realized this is. What I'm interested in is this quantity here. This quantity here are the matrix elements of this propagator here. If I know this quantity, I have everything, right? Because if you want, let me forget all the infinities for a moment. I mean, forget all the divergences and the infinities. I have a Hilbert space with a constraint which selects a particular subspace, which is where it's kernel, okay, and I have a projector on that particular subspace. If I take the matrix element of the projector, this gives me a scalar product on the big Hilbert space, which is degenerate, which kills everything which is not relevant, and the original linear space with this particular scalar product is precisely the physical state space I want. In other words, this is the physical inner product. Right? This is what I want. Is that all the theory is there. If I know that, I can compute observables in principle, I can...
H hat of n, you integrate
the
function
and
integrating over all functions.
Yeah.
Not numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there are various steps here. First, you have to believe me that this is a projector, and sure. You better not, in the sense that there are a lot of infinities hidden here, but I mean formally it is. Second, the matrix element of these things are what I'm interested about. Now I want to compute this matrix element. These matrix elements, just by expanding this, are given by a sum of terms in which the Hamiltonian acts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. So now nobody prevents me from writing that. The rest is more or less precise math. But I can write this just as a sum, I lost it, just as a sum over surfaces. Okay. These matrix elements have this form. There's no time here, there's no... Okay. Now I can just think of that, and reread this in a different form. This, if you want, is exactly what is in Stephen Hawking's papers. When you write the scalar product between two, three geometries as the sum over four geometries that are bounded by the initial and final three geometries. You can read it as a projector, as a matrix element of the projector obtained by exponentiated Hamiltonian constraints, the projector on the... Well, yeah. Yeah, and actually, most of this came from years of Jim Hartle tapping on my head and saying, you have to do a four-dimensional covariant formulation, otherwise you will never understand anything.
Is the equivalence of these topological quantum theories supposed to be complete? That is, we can dispense of all this connection business, so forth, and calculate everything? In terms of, in addition to the partition fractional expectation values?
The equivalence is with modified topological quantum theory, which is not topological anymore, right? So
some of the transparency cap of the previous Carlo said that, well, yeah, the big difference between topological quantum theory and the humongous and the guiding theory that once we have a finite number of things in the field,
then
generally
should
be able to infinite number of things.
So they're two different classes.
By the constraints of logical quantum theory, we will get something
with
infinite number of things.
Right.
Oh, it's not surprising. It happens that adding a constraint, you create new degrees of freedom. If you think of the BF theory, the way it works. You know it actually. A topological field theory with some additional constraint is not a topological field theory anymore. You're constrained at a Lagrange multiplier, so you're free in some degree of freedom. So the Crane-Yetter theory is topological. That's BF theory. And here you can look at BF theory. This is a theory of a connection and the two form, of course. And do a formal functional integral quantization, discretize it, and then what you get is exactly equivalent to this combinatorial thing here. So you go from the two formulas back and forth in a way you understand completely. That's for the topological field theory. Now let's go to generativity, which is not topological. Yeah. So now we have this constraint, which destroys the fact that the theory is topological. Now, with this constraint, you can have a modified BF theory, which is not topological anymore. That's why you have to sum over the possible triangulations. You have lost triangulation invariant. And this expression is exactly the same structure that the spin form that comes from there.
But that would just presumably have some regular behavior somewhere, this modified topological theory, otherwise you'll pass the limit, you'll have some trouble. In the topological theory itself, the triangulation invariant is in some sense the classical in this period. Now, if you break that, as you're doing by Crane and so on, then it's not topological, but it should be something. One should have a handle on it. So, does it follow from what we have?
What you're asking, how do I see the diffeomorphism invariant implemented in this theory?
If you do break the topological invariants, you should give it up and find something else, or maybe like some limit of your theory hasn't
been. The sum of the possible triangulations.
The other is behaving here, nothing.
There's no evidence of convergence. Why does it how does it behave? Those are precisely the questions which are being studied, and the reason for reformulating the theory in a compact form in this way was precisely that, right? In the sum over triangulations in two dimensions. It's believed to behave very badly, if you want, or was believed to behave very badly. If you can view this as one way of controlling it is expressing it as a quantum theory of matrices that you understand in closed form. Okay, so that's the way of combining the infinite expansion over the triangulation in a single field theory, that was done last week. So I don't.
In 3D, so you can also do the same thing.
As you point out, that is Krasnov. Part of this.
You can formulate a fundamental origin model using the strict Bose matrix models. What's the status of that? Can you get any extra insight by doing that? or does it help in any way? What in 2D we know.
Okay. In 3D, the question is actually reversed. The way the answer is I don't know what. What happened is that Bulatov was trying to take the idea of two dimension and expand it to three dimensions. So what he realized is that, contrary to other attempts that were done at the time, a way that worked to do that was, rather than take matrices with more indices of stuff like that, he took a field theory over the SO3, of the three copies of SO3, something analogous to this one, and the mode expansion of this thing here are the right variables for doing that. And what he ended up, that I believe was surprising, is that he got the two ideal model precisely.
He
got Pontano region model, you're right.
But as far as I know, that program just stuck. He could never get handle on some triangulations. He could not do anything with that perturbation theory.
I think just to answer Jim's question, so the big difference is some of all the triangulations, and that is where we are now facing again the kinds of problems that we always face in field theory. And so the way that at least many of us think about this whole thing is that the first part, or earlier part, coming with Thomas and Hamiltonian or some other Hamiltonian, looking at it in the canonical picture and so on, is probably the best way to establish that the theory exists. Mm-hmm. But it's probably the worst way to actually expect this sort of thing. And if one again, I could actually establish that the theory exists, then one would have much more, one already has this very attractive, but one would have even more faith if this sum should somehow converge or then this one might be.
Yeah.
The theory could exist in a sense of union and not have a classical unity.
Yeah, so the question is about it. Well, one should. Yeah, so when I say theory exists, no, I think I didn't spell it out, but I mean theory exists in sufficient semi-classical state. Otherwise, it isn't just infected, but it's a mathematical physics model rather than physics model then.
Can you show that just like Pozzano and Reggie showed that the six J symbols were given?
Yeah. There's a work by Barrett, I believe, in which. It's the integral of the Einstein-Hilbert action, of R. The cosine is the same subtlety of the I.
The
I think there are several points of view around the community. Another point of view, which is very influenced by that, is that anything that you write down, including something that came from a quantization of what you felt was the right thing, is likely to fail. And therefore, another game to play that some of us are trying to find is to take the freedom that Carlo mentioned, once you have something like that, to choose the dynamics at the vertices so that there is continuum. And use that as the search algorithm.
A question is sort of related to this right now. You basically explicitly showed us the spin film construction for this particular Hamiltonian. That the story goes through for a new dynamic.
Yeah.
And if it's just a little bit more concerned about
how that's going to be less concerned. Well, the last thing was drawn by the same. But
we have concern about the plane to go. Well, this Hamiltonian just acts at one vertex at a time. It's very easy for me to see pictorially what that does. Lee seems to want something that does something more complicated. And
no, there is a part. One way of viewing this. There is a part which is more structural, which is just this formula here, and there is a part which is more which change from model to model, which is a specific vertex that you mean. I mean, you allow one more surface, many lines coming in at the same time, and things like that, and the amplitude that associates this vertex, so this A thing here. So. With a caveat, which I'll add in a moment, all the models that I know, I believe, even if I've not computed that they all correspond to a given vertex, to a given choice of a vertex. Now, Lee has extra variables in his constructions, and this is slightly different because there's a quantum group in his construction. There's some, so there might be some further complications, but a quantum group, which is not here, but.
I mean, there's a little bit of philosophy. I mean, there what we're doing is very similar to this, but the philosophy is different. And started from this work of Plotinus to think about evolving things in a way which is Lorentzian and gives rise to a causal structure by altering the network by sequences of local moves and using the sequences of local moves to define a causal set, in order to bring in a kind of joining of this
there's one specific part of your question, which is what about this? The amplitude of a history here is the product of all the vertices here, right? I would say, and you asked, well, is that the general case? I would say yes, that's the general case, because that's what characterizes formalism. And if you want, this is what that's locality in this context. Right. I mean, what's locality in a context in which you have diffeomorphic invariants? Nothing is sitting nowhere. Okay, and the action of the Hamiltonian constraint from the canonical point of view is a sum of terms. Each one acts somewhere, and here the amplitude of this history is a sum of products. It's a product of vertex amplitudes which don't know about each other. It seems to me that's a key feature of the formalist, which is true in. Yes.
From the conclusion to the last transparency of the matrix model spin zone, can you reconstruct Hamiltonian constraints and see what the moves are and how it acts?
I don't think has been done, but I think it's in principle, yes. I don't know what kind of difficulties could come out from it.
Ted? I don't feel any progress on my question. I still have no idea what this has to do with time. And also, the other side of the question is how any of this addresses the deep and difficult problem of what is observable in a non, you know, completely background independent non-preservative quantum gravity. I mean, we know we're supposed to project down to the solutions of this constraint equation. But, you know, then what? I just somehow buy this sleight of hand of exponentiating the constraint. Suddenly we're talking like we know what the theory is about, and I have no idea, and I don't see why you don't.
Okay, so it's two different questions. Let me first discuss the first question. I believe you know it because I think you discussed it somewhere. There's a construction by Feynman and somebody other which is solving the Klein-Gordon equation. You take an extra time, fifth dimensional time, you evolve in it, okay? And you write a propagator, and then by integrating over this extra time, you get the projector on the. This is exactly the same thing going on here. You say no?
No.
Sorry?
Yes, I say no.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's just completely different. That construction gives you a path of integral representation of a propagator, which we insert in one piece in a Feynman expansion of the S matrix or something of a theory.
No. At the one particle level. At the one particle level. I'm not thinking of the field theory.
Are you thinking of this
book
Teitelbaum, called Proper Time?
Hi, Charles. Yeah, it's what Teitelbaum was doing. It's the same, it's always the same formula. Formal is the same thing, what Teitelbaum was doing, and it's strictly connected to what Jim was doing, and what Stephen Hawking was doing. The difference is that all these terms here are finite and computable. The only divergence here is sum. Okay, so this is, in other words, you can always trade a you can always trade projecting on the kernel of a constraint to with evolving and integrating over possible evolutions. That's what is going on here. That's the first part.
I see what you mean. But first of all, we integrate over semi-infinite range of that lapse, and that's because that's the time to getting the Feynman propagator and physical interpretation of that propagator, you know, involves separating positive and negative energy solutions and constructing a Hilbert space interpretation. It's not even an evolution operator, right? It's the Feynman propagator. So without all this other apparatus to interpret it, it really doesn't mean anything physical.
That
we have on top of that the problem of identifying observables that, you know, commute with the Hamiltonian. And I have no idea, I mean, we haven't even begun to think about this far, but we see in this context. So just formally writing down this path integral for this delta function of a constraint doesn't help me anyway at all feel like I know what's going on or how I interpret the result of doing that.
Well, it's to write this formula, to use this formula, you don't need to interpret this as an evolution of the time, right? So nobody forces you to interpret this as an evolution and that's perfectly fine, because if you want, at the end of the day, things have to be invariant under coordinate time evolution, right? So the coordinate time evolution in classical generativity is a gauge. So what we're interested in is only how things change with respect to each other, not how things change with respect to. So at the end of the day, the questions, as you're saying, have to be invariant under coordinate time, and they're coming up here. I personally, and many other people, nevertheless, find extremely useful the coordinate time in classical generativity, because that's allow you to think about the kind of how things evolve in the coordinate T, and then just look for things which are invariant under arbitrary parameterization of T. So you can. I find it useful, but I don't ask you to do it the same if you don't want to do it, to look at each term of this sum as a possible four-dimensional space-time. Okay, this is a non-gauge invariant description. So if you dislike it, that's fine. We are just attaching meaning to non-gauge invariant things. So I'm doing the same which I do in classical GR. I'm doing the same here in a quantum space-time. This is not going to affect the interpretation of a non-gauge invariant thing here. Is not going to affect whatever I compute at the four-dimensional diffeomorphic invariant level. That's as far as the first question is concerned. The second question, I find it much more interesting, and it's what are you going to compute, right? Now, physically, we know what things we can compute in generativity. Everything that we can compute in classical generativity, in principle, we should be able to compute in quantum gravity on a given state, right? In classical generativity, if I have a solution for an equation, I can compute something. And of course, I have to be very careful that whatever I compute, at the end of the day, does not depend on the particular coordinates in which I've written the solution and so on. So whatever is your preferred thing that you want to compute in classical GR, you can compute in principle, there is a corresponding quantity in quantum GR. There is a relatively simple way of formally constructing observables once you have the propagator, because you take any observable defined on the bigger Hilbert space, you sandwich between the propagator, and you get an invariant observable. Just bring it down, you project it down. And that's one way in which formally, work is going on in trying to construct physically four-dimensional gauge invariant quantities, observables. You may want there's a separate problem, which is that, as we all know since years and years, in generativity in general, it's difficult and complicated. It's always complicated to write down quantities which are invariant under four-dimensional diffeomorphism, right? You have to build up some sufficient structure to be able to do so.
Why is that so hard? What about something like integral over space-time with the Kretschmann scalar? It's a perfectly good number that you can compute in classical relativity. So if you have a quantum theory of gravity, what is the quantum expression for the expectation value in a state of the integral over all space-time
with
the Kretschmann scalar?
Right. So
in some states you will, and in some states you won't.
Yeah, and if you
in particular, if you have some scattering state, you know, for asymptotically flat on space times, presumably the question of scalar at early and late time is going to be small enough so that that's actually going to be finite.
Right.
There could be a whole class of
classical
states where you get a nice number.
So suppose,
there could be a whole bunch of quantum states
where you get a nice expectation. Yeah, so suppose I wanted to define this quantity in quantum gravity. Now, in the canonical formulas, I will be a little bit in difficulty because how do I do the integration over time, right? Here, well, in the canonical formulas, how do I define a quantity defined as an integration of four-dimensional space-time? Here it comes natural. But there's no T. There's nothing to. In classical GR, there's not a problem. In the canonical formulas, it looks very complicated to define something like that. I don't know how to do that. Here, I know how to do that, right? Because if I take a quantity integrated over three dimensions and I sandwich it between two of these things here, okay, you go through the algebra a little bit, and what you see is that what you get is precisely the integration, the sum over all possible locations of a surface. Here, okay, so you take your observable, a fixed time, and you sum it over wherever it can be. You sum over a discrete set of things, right? Because this is one, if you want, ADM surface. This is another one. This is another one, and so on. So it generates exactly the integration over time of the integration over the possible. So this is a formula which kind of naturally allows me to construct quantities which are integrated in a four-dimensional. Now, between saying that and doing that, there is a lot of work which I hope will be done and is being done.
So this is particularly lighter compared to the previous one. But as Carlos was said at the beginning, you know, if this is expression solved, S T is fine, because if you forget about infinity, you can get the capacity. So one side is sort of comes the problem on two sides. One side where things are intuitively clear and telling us how one might go about computing things, but they look divergent. Another side, one has precision, but one doesn't really know how to answer, one doesn't have people. Since you've answered, then you can answer precision and intuition.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that in classical general relativity, it's easy to come up with things that are, you know, perfectly good numbers.
No, I think Carlos' point was really, that was fun. Carlos' point was that quantity you said right now.
Yeah.
You could not really write it in the canonical framework, in which I don't have a four manifold, I just have three manifolds, because then I want to have to use this initial data. I will write the question of scalar of it, whatever scalar you have, in the integral space time, as a property of the initial data. And that's very hard, because that involves integrating the whole equation of motion.
Let me try to clarify this. Let me just write one quantity. You want a certain quantity, which is an integral in dt, an integral in d3x, of some functions of the field, which depend on x and t.
Yeah.
Okay? Some function of the field. Okay. Now this will be some kind of operators in my and the integral in d3x. I'm supposed to know what it means. What is the integral in dt? So suppose I have that. What is this at time t? In the canonical theory. Well, in the canonical theory, this roughly, okay, is this quantity here, the integral d3x, a of x, at zero, and then I have to bring it to time t. I'm being very sketchy here, right? So that's the quantity, that's all now. So in other words, I have to take this, evolve in a fictitious T, evolve with a Hamiltonian constraint somewhere, compute it there, come back and integrate. Okay. If you do this a little bit more properly and expand this, what you get, it's precisely this kind of formulas. Right? You have to evolve with Hamiltonian up to some point, compute the value of that function there, and integrate of all positions of the. So this is. This is a way of making explicit the t-dependent and view it. Of course, this integration dt, this is to connect to what Ted Jacobson was saying before, it's a gauge invariant, and that's exactly what you are saying. I want to compute this, which does not depend on t. There's no explicit dependency. T is something I want to integrate over. By opening it up and giving me a formalism in which the position in t is visible, so to say, the gauge invariant position in t is visible, is what allows me precisely to define observables of this kind.
It's perhaps worth mentioning, this is a closed loop that you started a while ago, and if you take this O, and you multiply it by your projector T. But that operator is just projector T times that thing you have there, which is the spatial part, the interval A over space, times the projector P.
So let me call this B, and this is O, is roughly P, B, P.
The problem is that the O times P is P, B, P. O, P, P, Q, B, is our design.
Sorry, go ahead. No, I was actually going to suggest that we break, and given Roger's flow frame with your minutes, and I think this has been a good discussion, and a great talk, and I was wondering if we might sort of schedule some time next week to sort of continue to discuss this and maybe even begin to discuss some more connections with the community.
Yeah, this is, actually there's nothing at the moment scheduled for Thursday, next Thursday. So that might be about time when we can get together for
that would be great.
Let's thank you.